From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 42 for Friday, the 9th of September, 2011. On the show this week...
Last week I flew White Knight 2, and that was a great experience.
Captain David McKay is Virgin Galactic's new chief test pilot and will be flying Virgin's White Knight 2 mothership and Spaceship 2. The former RAF test pilot will join us on the show later to talk to us about his first time behind the craft's giant wheel. But first, it's time to get lightheaded as we orbit our way around this week's supernova of Wired News. Hey there, I'm Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and joining me under Wired's Tree of Knowledge this week is news editor Duncan Gear.
Hello.
Here he is. Hello.
Hi.
And also in the middle of us is Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
How are we doing?
Good, thank you.
Fine.
We're in kind of a different room this week because someone was doing something ominous in our normal trinket cupboard, so we've hijacked the test editor of Wired Magazine's testing room.
If there's a slightly odder ambience than normal, then that will be why.
That will be why. Yeah. Duncan, before the show, actually gave me something quite interesting. It was a photo of a tropical storm called Nate.
Yeah, tropical storm Nate.
And I hope it hasn't killed anyone.
No, I don't think so. It's whizzing around the south of the Gulf of Mexico right now.
It's a very pretty picture. It's now up behind my computer, decorating my screen. It's very pretty. So yeah, we're going to get into some news. And I think on everyone's lips this week was the fact that Yahoo CEO Carol Bartz got a rather unpleasant phone call to tell us she was fired.
Well, she hasn't done much good, has she? Let's be honest here.
She's been there 2.5 years after joining from Autodesk, where she was a CEO there for about 10 years, I think. And, failed to kind of inject Yahoo with the vigour that it had in the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, Yahoo, I think, was without wanting to be too harsh, has been a little bit of a sinking ship for a while, perhaps even before she joined the team. So... she could have injected it with a few more, a bit more of innovation.
And their original, mission, which was, as a tech company, has just completely gone out the window. I can't remember the last time they launched something interesting and new and innovative.
The last time they did anything that I think really qualified as being innovative was Yahoo Pipes.
Yeah,
and
that was cool.
I wonder how many people listening will have heard of Yahoo Pipes.
But it's important to remember that Yahoo's still incredibly strong in many markets in the rest of the world, particularly Japan, and in China it's pretty strong as well. So it's not all bad news.
I'm fairly sure the Spice Girls are still fairly popular in Japan, though.
Yeah. That's...
And Shampoo, was it you said earlier,
yeah.
That old band that was on the end of the Power Rangers movie?
Oh, We're in Trouble. Were they?
Yeah, they were. They did like the closing theme to the old Power Rangers movie.
Oh, wow.
Bringing it back to Yahoo for a second.
Yes.
So what does this mean for the future of Yahoo? What is the next step?
Well, it's difficult to tell at this point because no one really knows what Yahoo was doing before Carol Bartz was fired, and less is sure now. I mean, a couple of years ago, they turned down an acquisition offer from Microsoft for $44.4 billion. Today, the company is now worth $17 billion. And some people are speculating whether Microsoft Steve Ballmer might step up and say, we'll still be interested. I mean, it's going to go for an awful lot less, I imagine, if they did step up that offer. But
I mean, I think the most value that they've got is in the things that they own, like Flickr and, probably mostly Flickr more than any others and various other sites as well.
You say that, but I mean, Yahoo's email is still massively popular.
Yeah.
Huge amounts of people. And they still have an enormous amount of people visiting their site. It's like huge numbers.
And I think most people do still have a Yahoo ID that they don't use very often, but that they have and maintain.
I use it every day. They have a lot of those casual games as well, which is a big market. We've seen a lot from Facebook doing things with casual games, and people like Zynga have built multi-billion dollar businesses off the back of these games. So there's a lot that they could do there, and they've closed a lot of sites down. Like, I mean, Angelfire was a bit of a blow when they closed that down. Unfortunately, they haven't touched Flickr yet, but...
So you're saying don't discount them yet?
I've never said discount Yahoo, it just needs to find its feet, but I think that it's, its big days are in the past, and I'm not quite sure how much it can do without being bought by someone like Microsoft at this point. But just as an interesting side note, Bart's resignation email went out to the company, and she said, "To all, I'm very sad to tell you that I've just been fired over the phone by Yahoo's chairman of the board. It has been my pleasure to work with you all, and I wish you only the best going forward. Carol, sent from my iPad." That sounds like the words of someone who just put the phone down and banged out an angry, blunt email to say I'm off. Well, wish her all the best, and Yahoo the best, of course, but hard times ahead, I think, for Yahoo.
Speaking of hard times ahead.
Yes. Copyright extension. Now, don't switch off. Don't fast forward. This isn't going to be as dull as it may sound. There's been a big bit of news today about the length of copyright extension in the UK. Duncan, this is so you.
Up your strasser.
This is copyright in the UK is controlled from Brussels, from the EU. And the EU regulators have voted to approve a pretty controversial directive that would allow musicians to retain their copyright over their sound recordings for an extra 20 years.
Now, this, I know in the past, has been referred to as things like the Cliff Richard Law, which amuses me. It tickles my giggle pants every time I hear that term. And also the Beatles extension.
Yeah, and the Why? Reason for that is because copyright currently on recordings currently expires 50 years after that recording is made. And almost exactly 50 years ago was when the Beatles were about to become the biggest band in the entire world. So what the record companies are terrified of is, and the content owners are terrified of, is those recordings going into the public domain and them not being able to make money off them anymore.
Because we all feel really sorry for the members of the Beatles and these hugely successful artists who haven't made any money from their recordings.
I mean, In truth, the motivation behind making this extension happen isn't really about bands like the Beatles and Cliff Richard and so on. It's more about the session musicians, and these are session musicians who played on, you know, these records in the 60s, and they don't usually get a cut of any royalties under UK copyright law, but they do get a tiny cut of some other royalties. And if the extension doesn't happen, then those people's incomes will get cut off overnight.
But this happens with all pensioners. Like, most people don't have this continuing source of income.
Yeah. When I'm 70, if I ever make 70, I'm not going to expect Condé Nast to still pay me for this podcast.
That's exactly what Roger Daltrey said to the BBC. He said, thousands of artists had no pensions and rely on royalties. They're not asking for a handout, just a fair reward for their creative endeavours.
Well, they've had
that for 50 years.
And exactly. And they should have been planning for the fact that they're within 50 years that money runs out. You know, if that's not what you're doing, then that's...
And most of them will have the writing rights, whatever you call them.
Songwriting, right?
Songwriting, yeah.
So there's
right.
a difference yeah. between being a songwriter and being a recording artist, because the people who write the songs aren't necessarily the people who play them. That was particularly true as well back in, you know, well, it's still very true in the pop world. You have a lot of people writing and producing songs, but they're not the people who actually record them. Britney yeah. being a great example there.
The copyright on the composition and the lyrics is a different copyright entirely, and that lasts a lot longer. That's the person who created that composition, those lyrics, their lifetime plus an extra 70 years.
So basically yeah. what we're saying here is that we're not going to be able to mash up Beatles recordings for YouTube videos just yet.
Or even just have them on Spotify.
I think it's a real shame. And this still hasn't been rubber stamped yet, though, is it? There's one more hurdle to get over.
No, it's going to be a little bit longer. On the 12th of September, which is, it depends on when you're listening to this, but it may have happened, the Council of Ministers will have the last say on the matter. And they're expected to just, yeah, agree, rubber stamp it. And then member states, including Britain, will then have to write them into law by 2014.
Well, let us know what you think, podcast@wired.co.uk. If you have any opinions, or go and post something on our Facebook wall, facebook.com/wiredUK. Let's move over to Sweden, where a retailer is doing something that, when I first saw it, I thought, what a great little bit of marketing PR. But actually, it's a little bit more interesting than that, isn't it, Liv?
Yeah, I mean, this is a kind of a new little business model from a retailer called, I don't know how to pronounce it, ICA Vanadis, I'm going to say. They're trialling this little system in Stockholm where the more people who pledge to want to buy a particular product, just as kind of Groupon works, the lower the price. And how they do this is they have a big screen in the shop showing a particular product and saying, if you check in on Facebook, the price of this product will reduce. So as more and more shoppers come in and they pledge their interest in this product, the price goes down and down and down. And think they do this once a week, and then once the price hits a certain level, you can buy it at a much kind of discounted price.
So has it been successful? I mean, it strikes me as being the kind of thing that everyone would jump on board for.
It's only just started, but I think it's like the kind of, you know, 2-for-1 deals you get for wine and other such things. You know, it's a kind of point of sale, panic purchase, that kind of added social pressure of seeing other people getting involved and being able to contribute to that. And I just think it's a nice little idea that could be rolled out as another kind of point of sale promotion type thing.
It's kind of a shame that Facebook deals hasn't caught on in the same way, because this kind of thing would get people into shops.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen this from, you know, people like Quidco as well. Duncan was saying before we started the show that, you know, these sort of people who, you know, allow you to check in and get a discount or get cash back. I mean, it's an incredible incentive to go into a store. If you knew that you could take 10 of your friends down to Dixon's or Curry's or something and you could all get 15% off an Xbox or whatever, would you not all just arrange to all go down? I mean, it's a great way to get people in store.
And it's really good for the retailers as well, because they get an incredibly detailed analytics on exactly who's in their store and when. And then they can market to these people. And they know that once you're actually in a store, they've got an incredibly good chance of selling you something. It's the difficulty comes in getting people to walk through those doors.
But, I mean, but you know what? There have been sort of anecdotal reports from the US, people who are on board with Groupon, that they've actually not wanted to keep using the service because it actually ends up not benefiting them at all. And Groupon takes a huge cut of the money, I think. And there is still a balance here to be addressed between how much retailers have to give the people providing a service. But if the store is doing it just on its own, then it has no one to pay a cut to.
And they can manage it based on, you know, the amount of demand that they can handle, or, you know, the products that they're trying to shift, which are about to go off and things like that.
These sort of, you know, fire sales, quickly, you've got to get it, you've got 60 minutes, literally, in fact, could be a great way to do this in future, particularly with the virality of people, you know, things like Twitter and Facebook spreading info. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, did you know that CEO of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, funded a rocket? Well, it didn't go very well.
Registration for the Wired 2011 Summit is now open. Don't miss your chance to hear some of the most inspiring talks from thought leaders of the wired world over 2 days this October in London. For more information, please visit wiredevent.co.uk.
Amazon.com, not necessarily known for its involvement in spaceflight, but it has a CEO, Jeff Bezos, who invests in a company called Blue Origin. Last week, though, during a test flight, one of Blue Origin's experimental rockets had to be destroyed after it was lost control of. Now, I'm not entirely sure what Blue Origin is, but I know that NASA co-invests in this as well, along with SpaceX.
Exactly. It's a private aerospace company. And yeah, NASA, as you mentioned, inputs money into it to do some research into things like nose cones and an innovative launch system and certain types of engines. So in addition to NASA, Jeff Bezos, however you pronounce his surname, also invests in this.
Yeah, so NASA, it was part of their Commercial Crew Development Program, and they were particularly interested in, as you said, the bionic or biconic nose cone design and restartable hydrolux engines. I'm not going to pretend to know what they are, but if NASA's interested in them, I'm going to assume that they're important.
The thing is, this is actually a bigger setback than it sounds, because I think, was it last week on the podcast, we were talking about how there's a possibility that the ISS may have to be evacuated later this year following the Russian rocket crash, the unmanned rocket crash, and that means that now astronauts currently can't get to and from the International Space Station. So if the Russians don't solve that situation by the time November comes around, the ISS is going to have to be evacuated after 20 years of continuous occupation. And what NASA is counting on is these private companies, these private spaceflight companies, stepping up to the plate and building these vehicles that can safely ferry astronauts to and from space. And if you know, they have problems like this with test flights and stuff like that, that's another step back for that project.
Quite interesting to say that Jeff Bezos lost a rocket,
but it's okay because he's got a tablet instead, probably.
Well, that's the other piece of Amazon related news, is that over the last couple of weeks there's been a lot of chatter on the net about Amazon's forthcoming Kindle tablet. Firstly, MG Ziegler over at TechCrunch reported that he'd actually held a prototype model, he'd used it, that it was a 7-inch tablet, which is about the same size as the BlackBerry Playbook or the HTC Flyer, which is to say quite small. It's going to run Android. It's going to be a very heavily customized version of Android, which I know Duncan isn't impressed with, and we'll probably talk about that in a minute. But the most important thing I think about this is that it could end up undercutting the price of the iPad by 50%, which is to say it could become the first properly...
mass market.
Yeah, the first mass market, strongest contender to the iPad. And it could launch before the end of the year. I have to say, pretty exciting. Right, Duncan?
It's kind of exciting. I'm not that fussed about it for two reasons. One, because as we said before, the version that you've got on it, the Android version you've got, is going to be heavily customized. It isn't going to be very much like many of the other versions. And as a result, there'll probably be a certain degree of compatibility problems with other stuff. And it makes it less likely that it's going to see future Android updates in a reasonably timely fashion.
But is that important when the apps are still going to run on it? Because Amazon has had this the Android App Store for quite a few months now. In fact, what, a year, maybe a year, something like that.
Yeah.
And you can use that store to put apps onto any, any Android phone.
I mean, I don't like the fragmentation of app stores that's happening on Amazon between GetJar and Amazon and the official Android store. It's starting to get a bit confusing as to which ones are free on which ones, because they're all signing deals with each other to try and offer certain ones free. And I don't want to have to run three app stores on my phone. I just want to be able to get all the stuff easily from one place.
But the bottom line here is you've got someone like Amazon bringing out a really affordable Kindle branded tablet, and we've heard from some leaks that it is going to be branded Kindle,
but
and it's going to run apps that you can buy from Amazon. I mean, it's all integrated. I mean, that's what Apple did so well. I mean,
yeah, but you love integrated. You're Apple boy.
I'm all for a self-contained ecosystem, and I agree with you that fragmentation sucks, and it's one of the problems that so many Android tablets have had a problem with, because you just can't ensure that apps are going to be cross-compatible with different devices, and this at least could solve it from every which way.
But hang on, do we have any confirmation that the apps won't be kind of compatible across different devices? I mean, what, can't it be customized and yet be open in the same way that other Android products are?
Well, I think the thing is that if you've got a highly customized version of Android, then that means that every time there's a new update or something is rolled out, then you're going to have to update all of your own apps. And that means that you're going to be probably 6 months, as long as 12 months in the case of some that we've seen with phones before, behind all the updates. And that's rubbish for consumers. It's not going to be good. My other problem with it, which I was coming on to before we got onto this, is that it's 7 inches. And I don't think 7-inch tablets are right.
Well, how big's the Kindle screen? 5 inches, isn't it?
Something like that.
Something like that. So it's going to be just a little bit larger than a Kindle, smaller than an iPad. But that does also mean that, and I'm going to get a bit geeky on this, that you can have pixel density on a screen, which means that the screen can be much, much crisper, even at a smaller size, because
As crisp as an e-reader screen.
No, but you're talking about a color screen that could bring basically things like graphic novels and proper picture books and photo books to the Kindle store and tie in with Amazon's Kindle service, its WhisperSync, its prices and things like that. I mean, that's a really exciting proposition as a standalone product.
My prediction, the Duncan prediction.
Can we call this Nostradunkus?
Nostradunkus. There's going to be a massive smash when it gets released. Everyone's going to get very excited about it. 6 months down the line, nobody will care.
But aren't we just seeing this as like a souped up Kindle as opposed to an actual tablet? Isn't this about having amazing reading experiences, maybe having your e-readers in there, but not necessarily being a kind of complete head-to-head iPad competitor?
Yeah, absolutely. From what we've heard so far, the interface is very much geared to be kind of like a iTunes cover flow style way of flicking through books that you've already got on your device, and then a way to acquire new ones.
Yeah.
And so it does seem to be very much geared towards reading and ebooks and media like that, in a way that the other tablets running on Android haven't done. So it could be quite exciting, and hopefully before the end of the year we'll actually get to see one.
If it exists.
If it exists.
Amazon, of course, still hasn't confirmed anything.
No. Let's move on to talk about something. We don't normally talk about cars very much, but Liv, you went over to IFA the other day and saw basically the future of the car.
Well, no, they made some announcements about the future of the car. They were talking about this Ford Evos car that they're actually launching at the Frankfurt Motor Show, that I think's in next week. But the Ford Evos is meant to be a kind of socially networked car that's connected to the cloud at all times and taps into all these your personal specifications. So depending on who gets in the car, it'll kind of automatically change to their particular settings. It will even monitor your heart rate, so that if you're feeling a bit drowsy, it might perhaps lower the temperature, or it might up the tempo of music that it's going to be playing.
So if it feels that you're getting too relaxed driving, it's going to pound out some hardcore drum and bass or something.
Yeah, very, very possibly. And the idea is that you could also be at home listening to your music, and then as it would would, the car would start warming up before you've left the house, or, you know, the engine would turn on, you'd be able to get into the car, the music that you were listening to, the track you were listening to at home would suddenly start in the car. And so it's just kind of quite nice. And then you'd also be networked to all your friends, so you'd be able to see what their favourite routes are to avoid certain traffic, or it would be able to predict where the kind of traffic jams are going to be and divert you.
And it ties into your calendar?
It can tie into your calendar as well. So,
and how much of this is a concept, and how much of this is actually a car that is going to arrive on the streets of Britain?
They're talking about this as it's a concept car at the moment, but they're talking about launching it as early as next year. I mean, the problem is with these things is that you have to have a whole network of cars having this to see its full potential. And actually, there's a study about this that's just been funded in the US at the University of Michigan that's looking at seeing the practicalities of these connected cars, specifically with a view of preventing accidents or predicting traffic. Because it's all very well having all these connected cars and all these different brands are launching them, but if they're not actually talking to each other in the real world, that you don't get any of these benefits.
We've heard a lot about this kind of connected car-to-car communication and the benefits it can have. We talked about it months ago on our Internet of Things episode, where,
and Google's been testing it quite a lot as well. They've been putting a lot of money into that field.
And the idea being that say you're on a motorway and there's a traffic jam up ahead. Cars can talk, you know, a car stuck at the front of the jam can tell the car at the back that there's a traffic jam, and that can keep going in sequence until you get far enough back that cars can be said, hey, there's a jam up ahead, but not before you get to junction 38, and here's a new route you could take to get around it. This is basically the kind of thing that this can enable, but on an even broader level, right?
Yeah.
Potentially, at least.
Potentially. And the US Department of Transportation estimates that they could actually avoid about 80% of accidents if this system was implemented and was to work correctly. So it'd be able to tell you that someone's braking really sharply 100 metres ahead, watch out, there'll be a pileup if you're not careful.
That kind of number, though, gets thrown around as if it's, I mean, up to 80%. I mean, it's a crazy figure.
No, they actually said 82%, and they're quite specific about it because the nature of the accidents that they record.
But this is one of those things where it would require every car on the road almost to have this kind of system. It would need to be as widespread as the fact that you can stop car crashes if you can see the other person in front of you is braking, so we all have brake lights. You know, it seems to need that kind of integration.
Yeah, it
and
does.
And be standard and not be some proprietary thing that only Ford can use.
It does. But they're talking about, you know, this is talking about the next 10 years of cars. We're not talking about this being in place next year and every, you know, this system being in place and working. This is they're doing a viability study over the next 3 years. And then after that, they would roll it out over 10 years if they thought it was going to work.
I think what's really important with this is that they build their cars over the next few years and so on, so that they can be updated, I guess, so that you can download a software update for your car.
Yeah.
That will fix bugs and stuff like that, but also introduce these new features as they become available.
Yeah.
I mean, so far with software in cars, we've often seen situations where manufacturers will put loads of cool things in, but then 2 years later, it's utterly useless because they've built in some music system that they did a deal with that nobody uses anymore, and they've shut down the servers.
Yeah, well, I think Ford's actually making a lot of effort to make sure that this system's future-proofed, and a lot of the Ford Sync system, which is the one that's currently in operation, relies on your mobile phone as the kind of communications hub. So as and when you get new mobile phones, you can just plug them in, and so the updates kind of come from your handset rather than any kind of it does have an embedded system, but it's not reliant on the technology from that's built into the car.
Well, we're going to park the car in our garage of the present and blast off in the rocket of the future as we swoop into the orbit of this week's feature.
In April, a job ad appeared on the website of Richard Branson's space tourism venture, Virgin Galactic. The company has launched its search for pilot astronauts, men or women who would be in the cockpit of the company's White Knight 2 mothership, or the Spaceship 2 spacecraft, as it travels up to 360,000 feet above our planet. Among the prerequisites are at least 2.5 years of postgraduate flight test experience, a minimum of 3,000 hours flying experience in a fast jet aircraft, and operational experience of an aerospace aviation project. And this week, wired.co.uk is speaking to the man they'll need to impress. Deemed to be light years above the rest is David McKay, a former RAF test pilot and Virgin Atlantic pilot, who has now become Virgin Galactic's chief test pilot.
We spoke to him from the venture's Mojave Desert test base in California. So, David, first of all, thank you very much for joining us on the wired.co.uk podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
I wanted to ask you, first of all, a little bit about the application process and what skills you had that matched the demands of this rather unusual job.
Okay, well, for me personally, I guess I was just in the right place at the right time. I happened to be involved in another project, which was also being built by Skill Composites out here in Mojave, way back in 2003-2004. So when Virgin Galactic started, and we became interested in the spaceship, then I happened to be around at the right time. And I had, I guess, the right background as well. So I drifted into it from that. For our newer pilots, then it's a different procedure. We've recently held a selection process, and we set the bar pretty high for that. We wanted the best types of pilots that were available. And we asked them to be qualified test pilots and have a variety of backgrounds in terms of types of aircraft. So we wanted them to have flown fast jets and large aircraft and have a certain number of hours. So we've now got a procedure in place which makes it perhaps a little bit more difficult to get into than when I actually got in myself.
Could you tell me a little bit about your background?
My background is that I learned to fly with the RAF whilst I was an undergraduate at Glasgow University in a system called the University Air Squadrons, which is where they train undergraduates to fly on light aircraft. And so after graduating in aeronautical engineering, I joined the Air Force. I stayed in the Air Force for 16 years, about half that time as a test pilot, mostly flying Harriers. But quite a few other aircraft as well. And then I left the Air Force in 1995 and joined Virgin Atlantic, initially on the Boeing 747, the jumbo jet, and later in 2002 onto the Airbus A340. And so I did, all in all, about 16 years in Virgin Atlantic as well, although for a lot of that time towards the end I was working part-time and laterally full-time for Virgin Galactic on a secondment. And so I've been working full-time for Virgin Galactic now for about 2 years.
But obviously you were a commercial pilot for many years. So what are the differences between flying a jet airplane and, for example, the White Knight 2?
Well, there are a lot of similarities and there are some differences as well. White Knight 2 is, just like the spaceship as well, is deliberately designed to be as simple as possible. Whereas something like an Airbus, an A340, is a very sophisticated machine with lots and lots of computers in it. White Knight 2, on the other hand, has got a simple manual flight control system. So there's a lot more pilot involvement, I think, in operating something like White Knight 2. And of course, the unusual thing about White Knight 2 itself is that it's got two fuselages. So you fly it from the right-hand side, which is about 50 feet away from the left-hand fuselage. So that's something that you've got to always remember. When you're actually flying it, it feels like you tend to forget about the fuselage on the other side, but you are a long way off from the center of the vehicle. So that's a little bit unusual. But other than that, you know, it's quite a large four-engined aircraft. And so there are also similarities as well as being, as well as having those differences.
And will you fly White Knight 2 as well as Spaceship 2?
Yes, I haven't flown Spaceship yet. I hope to do that fairly soon. We haven't got the rocket motor. That's not ready yet. That's still in test, but it's coming along well. We hope to have that in Spaceship next year, and I hope to perhaps do a glide flight before that, and then we'll get on to the rocket-powered flights. But last week I flew White Knight 2, and that was a great experience.
What did it feel like?
Well, it felt, I guess, largely as expected, because, you know, I've been to lots of meetings and talked to the engineers and the pilots, so there were no great surprises. But its performance is absolutely extraordinary. It really is a remarkable aircraft. It climbs extremely well at light weights, and you know, I set my own personal altitude record of 53,000 feet, and it's a wonderful view from up there. It's a great airplane. It's got lots of character, I would say. You know, it's a little bit quirky at times, but great fun to fly.
I've read that there could be commercial flights as early as next year, but there must be many a test flight before then. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's happening at the Virgin Galactic base at the moment?
Well, we're all busy working away, trying to make this project as successful and safe as possible. That's the headline, I guess. The spaceship, we hope to have the motor in it next year, and we hope to start test flights with the motor in the spaceship. We haven't set a date for commercial operations. We want to do it as soon as we can, but the most important thing is that we want to do it safely, and we don't want to put pressure on our engineers and technicians to try and achieve a date which might not be realistic. So we've always said it'll be ready when it's ready, and we won't rush it into service to achieve a particular date. So once we start test flying with the motor, I think we've always said that it'll be about 12 to 18 months of testing before we're ready for commercial operations. And we'll just have to see how it goes, see how well we're doing, how well our predictions are matching our actual test results, and make a sensible reasoned decision as to when to start commercial operations. But we're busy working away in it, and we're making good progress. There are no major problems at all, so everybody's optimistic and enthusiastic.
And when the commercial flights start, how many pilots will there be?
Well, we will probably have about eight. We're sort of playing around with the figures just to find out how many we want. We don't want to have a very large crew, because we don't want to spread the experience too thinly. On the other hand, of course, we need to have enough to operate the aircraft and to cope with pilots who have a cold or some other reason they can't fly. So we need to have some form of a backup, if you like.
So what's your advice to people who might be considering applying for this job?
Well, I think I'm probably biased, but I think it's got to be the ultimate flying job. The aircraft are very interesting and very exciting, and they really are pilots' aircraft. So, at the moment, we're recruiting qualified test pilots, experienced qualified test pilots with, as I say, a diverse flying background of fast jets and large multi-engined aircraft. But we are reviewing that process, and we think that in the longer term, you don't need to be a test pilot to do this. You just need to be experienced. But, we review our qualifications as we go along and as we learn more and more about how the vehicles operate. But for any young pilots out there, I would say, just get yourselves as much flying experience as you can on as diverse a background of aircraft as you can, and keep following the program. Look to our website and look out for any information on future recruitment on there.
I'm sure there'll be thousands of people who'll be now checking the website. Last of all, I wanted to talk to you about the passengers. I understand that over 400 passengers have already paid around £125,000 each for a ticket. Does the price of this ticket, and indeed also the historic nature of these flights, put more pressure on you as a pilot?
I think as a pilot, and I think probably most pilots of large aircraft, of airliners, would say that, having 400 people sitting behind you it is something that you are aware of, but you're always flying the aircraft in accordance with the limitations, and you're flying as safely as you can and as efficiently as you can. And you've always got to be aware, of course, there are people behind you, and you've got to consider them in the event of emergency or something going wrong. But, I wouldn't say it puts added pressure on pilots. I think for Virgin Galactic's operations, we will definitely have much more interaction with our passengers. We'll be involved in training them, because this is quite an unusual event, not just go into space, but because of the accelerations involved during launch and also in re-entry. It is unusual for the vast majority of the human race to do this. So we will be closely involved in the training system, and so we'll get to know them quite well.
Indeed. Well, it's an absolutely amazing program, and we will await with interest for the date of the first flight. And I'll start saving up my pennies to see if I can get myself a ticket in the next 20 years.
Do indeed, yes. Get in the queue. The queue is getting bigger by the day. So yeah, start saving.
Will do. Thank you, David. Thank you very much for joining us. And we will obviously watch out for more information from the website.
Great. Thanks, Katie.
That was David McKay, Chief Test Pilot at Virgin Galactic, speaking to wired.co.uk from the Mojave Desert, offering advice to any potential pilot astronauts out there. I'm Katie Scott, and I'm off to fill in my application form.
Thank you, Katie, and of course, David. I think the word is inspired to be a pilot. I do feel I am woefully unqualified to be a space pilot, though.
Can you even drive?
Physically, yes. Legally, no. Not yes.
But surely that has nothing to do with whether you can fly a spaceship.
Well, I don't know.
I don't think you need a driving license to fly a plane, do you?
I've no idea.
I don't think so. I think there must be some similarities between the two. I can't drive either, to be quite honest with you.
So I think I'm more qualified than both of you put together.
I can barely even ride a bike. I'm the Neanderthal of transport when it comes to stuff like this.
Or Liv's flying us into space then.
Yeah, don't worry. I've got a bit of a crush on David as well, so we'll be flying into space together.
I have to say, I was very fond of his voice. Very fond of his voice. Anyway, that's getting creepy. So let's end the show.
Sorry, David.
Let's end the show and tell people how they can get in touch with us. Liv.
Well, you can follow us on Twitter. Obviously, we're on at Wired UK. Nate is on at Nate Langson. Duncan is at Duncan Gear. And I am, as ever, at Olivia_Solon.
And Katie's at KatieScott1980,
if you want to go
and follow her, of course. Yes, and as we mention every week, we've got a brilliant Facebook page. And I do think that we have qualified it as being brilliant because there are loads of people on it and they seem to enjoy it and keep coming back. So go and join that. Facebook.com/WiredUK. Get some behind-the-scenes pics and things from the team here at Wired.
And exclusive competitions too. We recently gave away an iPad.
Oh yeah, that's true, we did.
Yeah,
we
did. So you don't want to miss that sort of thing.
Facebook.com/WiredUK. And if you want to email us, and you should, podcast@wired.co.uk. We expect your feedback and we do read it out. So do send some in. And on that note, goodbye and stay excellent to each other.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The band is huge in Asia.
Oh, we're in trouble.
Something's come along and burst my dot-com bubble. Yeah.